Before we talk about your appearances here in Maine, a big congratulations on becoming a member of the Grand Ole Opry.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's not something I wasn't sure that would ever happen for me. So it's been quite a sweet thing. And, you know, when that gets publicized, you hear from all kinds of people. I've heard from everybody in my college band. I've heard from my childhood friend whose dad first introduced me to bluegrass music, and all kinds of people in between. It's just been so sweet.
Let's talk about your appearances here. September 27th, the Opera House at Boothe Bay Harbor, and then on the 28th at Stone Mountain Arts Center. You picked a couple of beautiful facilities to come play at.
We love both of those places, and we always have a great time. And I have a fiddle player who's from Maine, so he, you know, makes sure we stop for lobster rolls every time the vehicle we're in stops for more than 5 minutes. So he gets to come home, and his family all comes out, and it's just always a very, very sweet, sweet thing to be in Maine. I just need to say, my oldest brother had never been to Maine, and he just got off a cruise around the coast of Maine. I was like, dude, 3 more weeks and you could have done one of my shows.
Well, Stone,
but he loved it.
Stone Mountain is so great, and I think a big part of that is because Carol Noonan, being a performer herself, understands what people need when they're out on tour.
You know, there are people who understand, and then there are people who are just naturally, they are naturally welcoming hosts. And it is the warmest place. We know we're going to be treated wonderfully. We know we're going to have a great time. It feels like, you know, it feels like a homey kind of place, like coming home in some way. And there's a unique thing that they have that I think is just part of it is that Carol's a performer, but part of it is that just that Carol's Carol. And I think she's just wired that way.
Speaking of coming home, going home, since the last time we talked, you added to your duties hosting Mountain Stage. And I wonder if that was like going home in a sense for you.
Oh, yeah, very much. You know, I go home a lot, but this was like when they asked me if I would be interested in doing this, they just sort of said, you know, there's lots of people who can do it, but there are not many people who understand what the point of view is when you're from West Virginia. And there's a whole lot about the show that is oriented even back behind the scenes to a kind of Appalachian hospitality that is kind of part of the culture there. And, you know, people come and they listen to each other's sets. And sometimes people, you know, have each other sit in, and people make friends, and old musicians who have been friends for years and run into each other. And it's just this wonderful kind of, it's almost like a party, but everybody goes and does their set. And so I felt like the chance to bring West Virginia culture to the forefront and continue what Mountain Stage started, not the stereotypical hillbilly thing, but actual West Virginia hospitality, and how special this show is. You know, I just thought, you know, I cannot say no, because I just think the work they've done and the ground they've laid is too important.
Last time we talked, it was right before the Ken Burns documentary came out, and I still think it's among his very best work. What did that do for the world of country music?
Well, you know, to have Ken Burns turn his lens on your world is it's a very unique experience. And because he does his research so thoroughly and he's so well respected, you know, there's a kind of legitimizing, you know, a sort of like, okay, we've put something into the world as a genre that has value. And, you know, I was one of the consultants on the film as well. And there was this moment where they had done the first edit, and they got all the consultants up to New Hampshire to watch the first run of the show over the course of 4 days. And there was a historian there who had written kind of he had written the Encyclopedia of Country Music, and when he did, all of his scholarly friends kind of poo-pooed him because he was studying country music. And at the end of the last screening, he just stood up with tears in his eyes and he said, "Thank you for validating my life."
Wow.
It was just beautiful.
Well, Ken's coming on with us in a few weeks to talk about his new series on the American Revolution.
Oh, I'm so excited about that. I mean, to have that story told by him will be a great gift for all of us.
We're talking with Kathy Matea. You work a lot with public broadcasting on not just Mountain Stage, but you're on the board of Nashville Public. You hosted a show there for many years. Why is, and I say this at a time when all of us in public media are a bit concerned about the state of things, why is public media important?
For one thing, the whole format of having something that doesn't have a commercial every 5 minutes where you can get into a little bit of a deeper conversation is something that's really important, especially as media gets more and more fragmented and kind of in its own silos. For me, you know, I discovered public radio when I was like 19 years old and I'd moved to Nashville and there were these long hours in an office that I had to pass. And I turned on the public radio station and discovered All Things Considered. And I was like, it was like the anchor to my life for a long time. And then I just branched out from there and just started keeping my radio on public radio and then got into public TV. And I just think that it doesn't just entertain you. It's not like mental chewing gum. It challenges you to think and it engages you and it enriches you. And I mean, really, I'll get on a soapbox for public media at any chance I get because I think it's really, really important.
Kathy, you've been very open through the years about the issues that you had with your voice changing, as it does for so many of us along the way. I think you told us a great story several years ago about the advice you got from Tony Bennett. But I also saw something recently. Can you talk a little bit about the grief workshop that you attended and how that affected you?
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny that you would ask about that because that's such a pivotal moment and I don't really talk about it very much. So I had been, you know, I've been working with this voice teacher to work through the changes in my voice. And part of why I did that was this little tiny, very short conversation I had with Tony Bennett one time, the one time I met him. And I was working through it, but I could not let go of my desire to have my old voice, to just have it all be effortless and to be 20 again. Like, who doesn't want to be 24 again, you know? And so I was just having a hard time. And a friend of mine had been through some tragedy. And another old friend from the West Coast was coming to Nashville to do a grief workshop that weekend. So I called my friend in North Carolina. I said, "Hey, you haven't had a break in a while and you've been through a lot. There've been some deaths in her family at this, you know, kind of all at once." And I said, "Come to my house and stay with me. We'll do this workshop together." So I went to take her. Well, I wound up doing this exercise where they took you into something. And as it turned out, they were rerunning the Ken Burns country music documentary that week.
Wow.
And I had happened to catch the episode that included my career and my husband's career. And I heard myself sing. There was a little clip from Austin City Limits. And I went into this meditation and that came up for me. And I just went all the way into it in this exercise that we did. And I was like, "I want that voice. I want that voice. I want that voice." And I was like, it's like when someone dies and you don't want them to be gone, you know? It was like a death. And I was able to sit there long enough that this voice came into my head and said, "Well, you don't have that voice anymore, but you've got the closest thing to that voice on the planet. And maybe that's enough." And that to me was like the bottom. And from there, I started working my way up. And I've come to appreciate my voice more and to nurture it more and to feel grateful for it rather than sort of like I have to kind of limp along, you know. I'm happy to have my voice now.
You've said before that music saved your life. I work with high school theater students and I always feel like one of the best things we do in the arts in schools is give young people a home or a place where they feel understood and accepted. Was that your experience?
Oh my God, yes. I was a high school theater student and was Ato Annie in Oklahoma, which was our senior musical, and did community theater in my hometown, which had a very strong community theater presence. And, you know, what I always tell people is I was this kid, I skipped the first grade. So, because I had this big brain. And when you have a big brain and you get the answers faster than anyone else in your class, you don't tend to be the most popular. Everybody else isn't as thrilled for you as you are and how smart you are. So I couldn't figure out how to fit in. And there was this moment where I went away to Girl Scout camp when I was 10 years old. And I realized that if you had a guitar, everyone wanted to gather around and sing the songs. And you didn't have to say anything. You didn't have to have any social skills. You didn't have to understand. You just had to, if you did this, you could not only connect with other people, but you could facilitate their connections with each other. And it was like freaking magic. I was just on fire. And God bless my parents. They got me a guitar for my 10th birthday. And I've never looked back. I'm 66 and I'm still, that's my joke, right? I'm still playing guitar around the campfire. It just looks a little different these days.
We just had our auditions last night for 9 to 5, the musical.
Oh, how fun. How fun. You know, I remember the magic thing to me about theater back then was you start with nothing and it's all wonky and you sing through the stuff and you read through the thing and then you do the blocking and all of a sudden your friends and your family come to the show and you've created this thing together that you never could imagine you would be able to do when you started. And I remember feeling like everybody was an essential part in something, but it only existed if everybody did their bit. And to me, that was the magic of it.
I feel like you've heard my pre-show speech to kids about everybody being important in this thing. You mentioned your big brain. People might not know, might not guess. I think you started college as a physics and chemistry major?
Yes, physics and chemistry and engineering. Ooh. And at the time, you know, like my dad only got to go to college as a fluke at the last minute. My mom never got to go to college, but was brilliant. And so they both grew up in coal mining towns. You know, both my grandfathers were coal miners and families were really poor. You know? And so they were like, you go do this music thing, but you get your degree first. You got to have something to fall back on, you know? And my mom was like, you have a big brain. You're good at math and science. And there were like quotas at the time for how many women there was equal opportunity, you know, was coming up. And so she was like, she just kept saying, honey, you can write your own ticket. Can write your own ticket. And they had grown up with so much insecurity that they wanted their kids to have the ability to support themselves and live a good life. And I could understand it, but I always have said, you know, I think it really says something beautiful about my parents that I called them up after 2 years and said, I'm going to go to Nashville because I knew my friend was moving. And I thought, if I don't go with somebody, I will never go by myself. I won't be able to take it. I won't be able to it'll be too big of a city to be alone. And so I was like, if I don't go now, I'll never go. And if I never go, I'll always wonder what would have happened. And they, you know, with all of their history, they still supported me. And I think that takes a lot of guts as parents to watch your kids do something that's terrifying to you and still, you know, and not abandon them. And they were really good to me about it all.
I remember playing Street Talk right out of the box, as we used to say in the radio days. Boy, the business is so different. I was thinking about this. How many labels were there in Nashville when you signed with Mercury?
There were 6 major labels at the time, and I was on the smallest of the 6, which in some ways was a hindrance. Our budgets were smaller, but in some ways was a gift for me. I came to understand because nobody at that record company was telling me what to do. They trusted me as an artist to find my way, and they were patient with me because it took me a couple albums to sort of find my voice, and they didn't drop me. And it wasn't until a few years later, talking to some of my contemporaries, that I realized that wasn't true for many people. You know, if you didn't have a hit right out of the box, they'd drop you. And I mean, it was my third album where I had my first hit. And they were like, nope, we believe in you. We just think you have to find your way. And there were times when I wished I was on a bigger label with more power, but I think it worked out in hindsight beautifully for me, and I wouldn't change a thing.
And then I think on the second album, I began working with the great Alan Reynolds, who understood that if you keep things simple and focus on your incredible voice, you create a timeless sound, and those records 35, 40 years ago hold up so well today because of that.
Yeah, I was really, really lucky. Alan is now best known for being Garth Brooks's longtime producer. But at the time, he'd been known for doing Crystal Gayle and Don Williams and a lot of really classic records. And he used to just look at me. We used to call him the guru because he was just this very wise presence and delightful to be around, very gentle. And I remember him looking at me when I was, you know, in my early 20s and saying, it's the song, pal. It's just the song. Don't you let them tell you what's in style or what's in vogue. He said, if you find a great song and you sing it honestly and you frame it well, it will not exist in time. It will be timeless. And I've had the chance recently to see him and tell him, you know, that I'm reaping the rewards of that advice at this stage of my life. And it's been a great gift. These songs have not, they have not gotten old for me. They just, you know, they really are timeless. They're timeless for me as a performer as well.
I was thinking about all the people you've worked with, the people that you've been able to get to sing on your album, beyond the world of country music, people like Michael McDonald, Carla Bonoff, the Roaches, my friend Jonathan Brook, Andrew Gold, many talented people that have been part of producing your records through the years.
Yeah, some of those are I was a fan of Andrew Gold, and I worked with Josh Leo, who knew him well. And so, you know, he and Carla Bonoff and Wendy Waldman and Kenny Edwards were all part of a group in L.A. in the 70s called Brindle. And they never had any big hits, but in the industry, they were very well respected. So they came and sang on the records. And, you know, that Andrew Gold connection was something I never would have had otherwise. And he was a brilliant musician. Just watching him work in the studio and the way he heard harmonies was just an education for me. And, you know, it's a real gift to get to collaborate. And sometimes it happens randomly, and sometimes you make a connection. And I mean, you know, Emmylou Harris is all of our, everybody in my generation, she's our hero. And she's come in the studio and sung, and she is so generous about it. You know, everyone loves her and everyone calls her, and she just says yes. She just is like, yeah, sure, I'll come sing harmony with you. And it's part of what I love about working in Nashville, that there is that spirit still here. Even as the music industry's gotten bigger and bigger, there is a real community here and a real collaborative spirit. And that seems to still be alive and kicking. And it makes me so happy to see that.
I wanted to ask you about this. We were talking about Ken Burns. What was the experience like for you seeing the story of your husband, John, writing and creating Where Have You Been, seeing that as part of that Ken Burns documentary?
Oh, my God. I mean, we had no idea. That, you know, we just went up to see the first draft of the final cut of the 8 hours of stuff. And that last episode where we were part of it, I had no idea. I was sobbing. We were both sobbing and speechless. I mean, you know, I kept looking at Dayton Duncan, who was the lead producer on the project. And I just kept saying, you know, if every shred of interview footage I did winds up on the cutting room floor, I'm fine with it. Please just, you know, do what you need to do. And I had no idea, but he had personally been really touched by that song. He had a personal story about it. And so, you know, it was like, really? Like, don't you want to do like a little more on Merle Haggard and take me out? You know, like, where do you draw the line? And we just had to like let go and trust them to do what they felt was best. And to have that powerful of a storytelling entity tell your story is, it's an honor, and it's really, really humbling. You know, I was I was a mess for a good while into dinner that night.
I was thinking so many of your songs, I think, are in the canon of modern country music. Where Have You Been, 18 Wheels, Going Gone. My favorite, the song that never fails to make me crack, is When I Hear A Few Good Things Remain. What does it mean to you at this stage of your career to know that those songs still have life today, still sound as good and mean as much to people as they did when they were first recorded?
Oh my God, it's everything, you know? It's what you wish for when you start, but you can't put it into words. And, you know, one of the really interesting moments that it's turned out to be something that's happened more than once, but there was this moment on Mountain Stage where this band came on and they were amazing. And this young woman was the lead singer. She was very nice. And she had like a 4-octave range, and she's scatting and she's doing jazz and she's singing. And this band is amazing. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm so glad I got to hear them. And so she walks off stage after her performance and she stands next to me and she says, I just need to tell you that when I met you this afternoon, I didn't realize that you were you. And my parents played your records my entire childhood. When I was growing up, I grew up on your music, and my mom is blowing up my phone right now. And I said, let's get a selfie for your mom, you know. But so many people have come through that I have gotten to see my body of work reflected back in the next generation, and realize that some of them have no idea who I am or ever was. And some of them were raised on, among other things, my music. And just to know that and to get to see it and see the meaning it has for people is something that would never happen to me probably if it hadn't been for hosting Mountain Stage. So that's another little kind of unexpected, sweet thing about this gig.
Kathy, it is always a delight to talk with you. Thanks, as always, for making time for us, and enjoy your time here in Maine later in the month.
Thank you very much. There's a lobster roll or two with my name on them.
I sure hope so.
We're looking forward to coming back.